From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Democrats and Republicans in Congress came together last night to give Terri Schiavo's parents another opportunity to save their daughter's life. This is a complex case with serious issues. But in extraordinary circumstances like this, it is wise to always err on the side of life.
Dear, if Congress acting as the Super Supreme Court of Florida is the right thing to do for Ms. Schiavo, why do you go to such pains, those of you who wrote the bill, to say that it shouldn't be a precedent?
A federal judge has refused to order the reinsertion of Terri Schiavo's feeding tube after unprecedented action by Congress to allow her case to be reviewed by federal courts. First, we'll speak with Congressmember Barney Frank about the extraordinary session Sunday night, then a debate on the case of Terri Schiavo with a bioethicist and a member of a disability rights group, not dead yet. Then, today is World Water Day. We'll take a look at privatization around the world and in this country, in Detroit and Stockton, California.
City Council members, by signing this contract without the vote of the people, you will be betraying the people you supposedly represent. Water is life. This company, OMI Thames, wants to profit from our water. Water for life, not for profit.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge has denied the request of Terri Schiavo's parents to order the reinsertion of a feeding tube for the severely brain-damaged woman. The decision was first reported early this morning. According to the Associated Press, U.S. District Judge James Whittemore wrote that Schiavo's life and liberty interests had been protected by Florida courts. He wrote that, quote, despite these difficult and time-strained circumstances, this court is, quote, constrained to apply the law to the issues before it. Attorneys for Schiavo's parents said they will now file an appeal at the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta, Georgia. Schiavo's case has been the center of a national debate on euthanasia. On Friday, doctors at the direction of a state court disconnected the feeding tube to Schiavo, who's been in a vegetative state for 15 years. The move was supported by her husband, but not her parents. The Congress took the extraordinary move of signing special legislation to order a federal judge to review the case. We'll have more on this story in a few minutes. In Minnesota, 10 people are dead after a high school student went on a shooting rampage Monday on the Red Lake Native American Reservation. Police say a 17-year-old student killed his grandfather and his grandfather's girlfriend at their home. He then traveled to his high school where he shot dead five students, a teacher, and a security guard. Another 12 people were injured. One student described being inside.
Boom, boom, boom. A couple more shots went off and they told us to get down.
After the shooting, police say the student then shot himself. It's the nation's worst school shooting since the Columbine High School massacre that left 15 people dead in 1999. Monday's shooting took place on the reservation of the Red Lake Chippewa Tribe. It's located in a remote area about 240 miles north of Minneapolis and about 75 miles south of the Canadian border. The Associated Press reports the tribe is one of the poorest in the state. About 40% of the reservation's residents are unemployed and live below the poverty line. Red Lake High School has 300 students and is one of the worst performing schools in the state. The school scored second lowest out of all Minnesota schools last year on tests for 11th grade math and third lowest for 10th grade reading. Floyd Jourdain, Red Lake's tribal chair, said Monday was, quote, without doubt, the darkest day in the history of our tribe. Jourdain said, quote, our community is in shock. Our thoughts and prayers go to the victims' families. We're a small town, and everybody is stunned. Monday's killing marks the nation's third high-profile shooting in the past 2 weeks. In Georgia on March 10th, a man appearing in court on rape charges managed to shoot dead the presiding judge in his case and three others. On the next day in Wisconsin, a gunman opened fire at a church service, killing seven, including the church's minister. An attorney in Australia has claimed the U.S. government holds 500 hours of video footage recorded at Guantanamo Bay. He says the footage, if it's ever made public, would prove to be as, quote, explosive as anything from Abu Ghraib. The attorney, Steve Kenny, once represented the Australian detainee, David Hicks. Meanwhile, a newly released FBI memo shows U.S. officials had grave doubts on the effectiveness of the coercive interrogation techniques used at Guantanamo Bay. One FBI agent concluded the interrogations produced intelligence that was, quote, suspect at best. The memo containing this conclusion was originally released by the Justice Department last year, but at the time, the department blacked out the agent's conclusion that the intelligence was suspect. FBI agents and officials have complained about numerous interrogation techniques used, including the shackling of detainees to the floor for periods exceeding 24 hours without food and water. The agents also complained about detainees being draped in Israeli flags and the use of growling dogs to scare detainees. The Boston Globe has determined the jet leased out by the government to secretly carry detainees around the world has a tie to the city's baseball team. The Gulfstream jet is owned by a part owner of the Red Sox. He leases the plane out to the government when it's not being used by the team. One time the plane was spotted was in Cairo, February 18, 2003, shortly after an Egyptian cleric disappeared from the streets of Milan, Italy. The Italian government is investigating whether the CIA illegally kidnapped the cleric from Italian soil. The Chicago Tribune has reported the plane has made at least 51 trips to Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, as well as trips to Afghanistan, Morocco, Dubai, Jordan, and Azerbaijan. At the United Nations, Secretary General Kofi Annan proposed a series of sweeping reforms to the world body. Annan called for four main changes: increasing the size of the Security Council, setting out rules on when the UN can authorize military force, having UN member nations agree on a common definition of terrorism, and reforming the UN Human Rights Commission. Kofi Annan spoke at the UN on Monday.
I urge member states to make the Security Council more broadly representative of the international community as a whole, as well as of the geographic realities of today. This important issue has been discussed for too long. I believe member states should agree to take a decision on it, preferably by consensus, but in any case, before the summit.
In military news, the U.S. Army announced Monday it's raising the maximum age for new recruits to join the part-time Army Reserve and National Guard from the age of 35 to 39. The moves come as the reserves are falling short of recruiting goals. And the Orange County Register of California is believed to have become the first major market daily newspaper to call for the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. This according to editor and publisher. The paper, which has a circulation of 300,000, ran an editorial for U.S. withdrawal on Monday to mark the second anniversary of the Iraq invasion.
When the good rains finally came, we stood out under cover. Watched the dry earth drink it up like a long-lost lover. We opened up our senses to let it in. Felt so good to feel that way again. And if you love the water, let it rain. Let it wash away your pain. There are reasons to explain. If you love the water, let it rain. A long time ago when the world was young, innocent life beneath the summery sun. Desert flowers and the wild plantain, waiting for the weather to bring the rain. And if you love the water, let it rain. Let it wash away your pain. There are reasons to explain. If you love the water, let it rain. is such a fleeting thing. You know, it comes and it goes. It ebbs and it flows, or waterfalls and rainbows. There was a time we kept ourselves apart, surrounded by the dryness in our hearts. But life is a natural mystery, they say. So I guess we'll just let nature have its way. And if you love the water, let it rain. Let it wash away your pain. 'Cause there are reasons to explain. If you love the water, let it rain. If you love the water, let it rain.
If you love the water, let it rain. Jim Page in our Firehouse Studios here at Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, jimpage.net. I'm Amy Goodman. Today we look at the Terri Schiavo case. A federal judge has refused to order the reinsertion of Terri Schiavo's feeding tube. The ruling by U.S. District Court Judge James Whitmore held came after a two-hour hearing Monday on the request by Terri Schiavo's parents to reinsert their daughter's feeding tube. The tube was disconnected last Friday on orders from Florida Circuit Judge George Greer. The ruling was supported by Schiavo's husband, but not her parents. It marked the third time the courts have ordered the removal of the tube in the last 2 years. But late Friday night, Republican lawmakers approved legislation, or Sunday night, to allow a federal judge to consider reversing the decision of the state court. The bill won the backing of virtually all the Republicans and almost half the Democrats in the House. In this rare Sunday session, members of Congress were called back from their Easter recess to tackle the case. President Bush also interrupted his vacation at his Crawford, Texas ranch to sign the bill. Speaking in Tucson Monday, Bush applauded the dramatic legislative maneuver by Congress to get the case before a federal court.
Democrats and Republicans in Congress came together last night to give Terri Schiavo's parents another opportunity to save their daughter's life. This is a complex case with serious issues. In extraordinary circumstances like this, it is wise to always err on the side of life.
Terri Schiavo's husband, Michael, spoke out against the extraordinary session by Congress.
Right now, I'm very outraged. It's a sad day for Terri, and it's a sad day for everybody in America because the government is going to trample all over your personal and private matters. This is an outrage. They have no business in this matter. Terri made her wishes. It has been adjudicated in a state court over the last 7 years. 19 judges have heard this. Appeals have been heard. The Supreme Court justices have heard this. And now the House of Representatives and the Senate are saying that they're wrong. They're thumbing their nose up the Constitution.
Following today's decision by the federal judge to order the reinsertion of Terri Schiavo's feeding tube, attorneys for Schiavo's parents said they'll file an appeal at the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta, Georgia. In a few minutes, we will have a debate on the case of Terri Schiavo. But first, we wanted to take a look at the extraordinary measures taken by Congress. We turn now to an excerpt of the Sunday night session. We turn to Trent Franks, Arizona Republican.
Mr. Speaker, perhaps it is important for those of us in this chamber to first remind ourselves again of why we are really all here. Thomas Jefferson said, "The care of human life and its happiness, and not its destruction, is the chief and only object of good government." Mr. Speaker, protecting the lives of our innocent citizens and their constitutional rights is why we are all here. The phrase in the 14th Amendment capsulizes our entire Constitution. It says, "No state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law." It is unconscionable that judges holding responsibility to protect Terry Schiavo's constitutional rights, have chosen to abandon those responsibilities, so now that Congress has no honorable alternative but to respond as we are. Hubert Humphrey once said that a society is measured by how it treats those in the dawn of life, those in the shadows of life, and those in the twilight of life. It is true that Terry Schiavo lives among us in the shadows of life. But she is not brain dead or comatose. She is awake and she is able to hear. She's able to see. She's often alert. She can feel pain. She interacts with her environment. She laughs. She cries. She expresses joy when her parents visit her and sorrow when they leave. And Mr. Speaker, she reminds me so much of another woman whose name I will not mention, who was in much the same circumstance as Terry. And a young nurse insisted every morning on singing to this patient. And of course, her colleagues upbraided her and said, well, she can't hear you. Those are just reflex actions. But she continued day after day, year after year, to sing to her every morning. And finally, she left the hospital. And yet a few years later, the patient regained her state of mind and came back, as it were, to a healthy, clear mind. And all of the nurses gathered around her and met with her. And they said, do you remember when we took care of you, when we turned you to keep you from getting bed sores, when we washed you, when we tried to feed you? And she said, no, I don't remember anything except someone singing. Mr. Speaker, Terry Schiavo represents the mortality and helplessness of us all as human beings. And whether we realize it or not, we are at this moment lying down beside her, listening for that song of hope. And if we as a nation subject her to the torture and agony of starving and thirsting to death while her brother, her mother, and her father are forced to watch, we will scar our own souls. And we will be allowing those judges who have lost their way to drag us all one more ominous step into a darkness where the light of human compassion has gone out and the predatory survival of the fittest prevails over humanity. If the song of hope is to be silenced, Mr. Speaker, let it not be tonight. Thank you.
Arizona Republican Trent Franks on the Schiavo case. As we turn now to a debate, we're joined by two people. Ken Goodman joins us from Miami, director of the bioethics program at the University of Miami. We're joined from Chicago by Stephen Drake, a research analyst for the disability rights organization, Not Dead Yet. Let's begin with Ken Goodman. Your response to the latest ruling in Florida, federal judge has ruled that the tube will not be reinserted into Terry Schiavo.
What you notice is a consistent pattern of judges from local circuits to federal appeals, all coming up with exactly the same conclusion. You notice a series of neurologists, board-certified neurologists, all coming up with the same conclusion. You notice doctors, lawyers, and people who teach ethics in our medical schools all coming up with the same conclusions. It has nothing to do with what you just heard from the representative. It has nothing to do with euthanasia, nothing to do with starvation, nothing to do with dignity. It has to do precisely, well, with the flip side of dignity, namely the right to refuse medical treatment. Terry Schiavo is not being starved to death, and anybody who uses the language of starvation and suffering is doing so to deceive you. Talk about framing the debate. That's exactly what's happened here for partisan political purposes. She is uncontroversially in a persistent vegetative state, according to credible neurologists. That does not include any members of our Congress. And the fact of the matter is, anybody who suggests otherwise is trying to advance an agenda that has nothing to do with poor Terry Schiavo.
Stephen Drake, your response.
Well, I wish I could say I was surprised. I think by this time, you know, the judiciary, where, you know, whoever they are, you know, kind of are seeing this as, you know, especially the way it's being framed as an assault on the courts, whether that's true or not. And, you know, one thing I would actually agree with is that this has been portrayed as a partisan issue. And of course, with the groups that I'm affiliated with, you know, we see it as much more complicated than that. It's really not surprising that we'd see this many judges, siding in this way in a case like this. This is historically a pattern we've seen. I mean, it goes way back. If you look back in the mid 1980s, two separate judges signed off on the starvation death of an infant with Down syndrome, something that is recognized now as something that's unconscionable. But, back at that time, they had no problem doing it.
Stephen Drake and Ken Goodman, we have to break. We come back. We also are going to go back and look at the story of Terri Schiavo, how she ended up in the condition she was, and understand what is the care she has gotten over this more than a decade. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Sometimes I feel,
sometimes I feel
like a mother,
sometimes I feel like some
child's
child,
Motherless Child, Sweet Honey in the Rock, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about the case of Terri Schiavo with Stephen Drake, research analyst for the disability rights organization Not Dead Yet, and Ken Goodman, director of the bioethics program at the University of Miami, where Democracy Now! Broadcasts each week on WVUM. Ken Goodman, you have been following this case from the beginning. If you can please just give us the background. It was very hard, even after watching Congress for 3 hours on Sunday night, to understand what happened to Terri Schiavo. Why did she end up in the condition she is in?
It's significant that by watching Congress, you didn't learn very much about the case. 15 years ago, last month actually, in February, she had a heart attack as a result of a potassium imbalance caused by an eating disorder. That's pretty well established. She was, unfortunately, like many people, not able to be resuscitated in time, and as a result suffered hypoxic or anoxic brain injury. Large portions of her cerebral cortex were damaged, severely damaged by that heart attack. In fact, she's been described as being neurologically devastated. Since then, she's been taken to various forms of rehabilitation. They haven't worked. She's been in a number of different organizations, and in fact, when neurologists were able to examine her, made a diagnosis that she's in what's called a persistent vegetative state. What's happened is in the intervening 15 years is that brain tissue that died 15 years ago has now been replaced with spinal fluid. That is to say, her cerebral cortex is full of spinal fluid. Electroencephalograms of her brain show that her cortical EEG is flat. She has what's been called cortical death. All of the stuff that you're hearing, all of the videos you're watching, all of the testimonies that you're getting wind of that suggest this poor woman is there thinking about lunch and she's interacting, they're all false. They're wishful thinking, and they underscore the tragedy of this awful case. Poor Ms. Schiavo cannot see, she cannot hear, she cannot feel, and she never will be able to again, according to credible neurologists. People who disagree with that are trying to advance an agenda by aligning themselves unhappily with the disability rights movement, a movement that didn't care too much about before Terri Schiavo. Terri Schiavo is not disabled, by the way, according to any credible definition, and the use of disability language and the use use of starvation language is purely intended to deceive people and move forward a narrow political agenda. This was settled area in law, medicine, and ethics for a generation, that just because you have a device or a treatment, in this case a percutaneous endoscopic gastrotomy, does not impose on you a moral duty to use it. Same with ventilators, same with dialysis, same with chemotherapy and everything.
Before we get into the debate,
activist judges,
Ken Goodman, before we get into the debate on that, because I do want to bring Stephen Drake in when we deal with that, I still wanted to stay with the facts of the case of what happened. A lot of aspersions cast on her husband, Michael Schiavo, that he might be doing this for some kind of monetary gain, that he has two children with another woman who he wants to marry, that he wants to get Terry out of his life. Can you describe what happened from the beginning? When did the parents of Terry Schiavo and Michael Schiavo split? Because at the beginning, they were together caring for her.
They were indeed, and some of those details are unknown publicly. Originally, there were disputes about everything from how to treat her, as I understand it, to how to spend the malpractice money. The money's all gone now. The money has overwhelmingly gone to legal fees and to pay for her care. The family dispute now is between a husband and his in-laws, and the allegations against Michael are quite interesting. I don't know what to make of them. I'm not sure that even if they were true, they should have any bearing on whether or not this poor woman should have a tube taken out of her stomach. The facts of the case are the neurologists agree about her diagnosis. There is no more money left in any estate. No one stands to gain any money now. The costs of her care are being paid for by the government and by the hospice she's in, which is providing some pro bono care, as many hospices do. And by the way, hospice bids fair to be devastated nationally by cases like this if they move forward. And you have an unhappy family situation that's been litigated in the courts. What's not in dispute among people who are credible is that she has the diagnosis she has. Whether the husband's a good guy or a bad guy doesn't seem to bear on the case at all, because ordinary people seem to be in complete concert with what he's requesting. He says this is what she would not have wanted. Not surprising, most people who, if you ask them about whether they'd want to be in a persistent vegetative state, would say they don't want it either. What's striking is the facts of the case are uncontroversial until they need to be twisted to move forward a political agenda.
Stephen Drake of the disability rights group Not Dead Yet. This whole issue of whether Terry Schiavo is in a persistent vegetative state, and the question of what people decide when they say, if something happens to me, and talk about what they want done.
Yeah, I find it fascinating when people talk about how clear a so-called diagnosis persistent vegetative state is. Just about a month ago, the New York Times had an article on some recent research about looking at people with so-called minimally conscious state, looking at unsuspected neurological activity. And there, a fairly mainstream bioethicist, Joseph Finz, was quoted as saying, as an aside, that with persistent vegetative state, there's a 30% misdiagnosis rate. Which means, you know, that...
It's nice...
Anyway, that there's this whole unrecognized field that, you know, after this short, intense period of looking at people, you know, for consciousness, people tend to stop looking. And in various studies over the past 15 years, they've found groups of people, when people have gone to them, either technologically or through intensive evaluation, that a significant number of people who get labeled as permanent or persistent vegetative state, in fact, are not. But it takes a lot of work to detect that they're not.
Ken Goodman, you're shaking your head.
Terry Schiavo is not in a minimally conscious state. People who, after 15 years, I think that the people who've done the diagnosis, who've done the CT scans, who've done the EEGs, are unambiguous in their diagnosis. The fact of the matter is, research on people who are in a PVS shows they never, ever recover the way the congressman suggested Terry Schiavo might. It's a tragedy, and it's a tragedy that unfortunately is being exploited for purposes that I'm troubled by deeply. I think that some of the people in Congress sincerely believe what they've heard, but what they've been heard, what they've been told rather, what they have heard is false. They've been deceived by people who are trying to advance an agenda that says the judges are all wrong. This is about judicial activism, that it has to do with religion, it has to do with abortion, it has to do with judicial activism, it has to do with trying to inject values of extremists into mainstream culture. People are taken off medical treatment every day, and that we'd settle that in medicine, law, and ethics, we'd settle it across the faith traditions, and we'd never had to deal with the idea that because you terminate treatment, because you withdraw a medical intervention, you were doing anything bad to anybody. Valid consent and refusal are at the foundation.
There's always been a problem when it comes to third-party decisions. I mean, these are the same kind of noises that were being made, you know, 20 years ago when it came to what was a fairly widespread practice of killing off infants with disabilities through withholding and withdrawal of treatment. And again, those got defended as private, painful decisions between doctors and families. And of course, you had the same uncomfortable alliance, you know, of these conservative pro-life groups and disability groups who, you know, find themselves, you know, opposing these things, not there for the same reason, clearly a different political agenda. You know, we're looking at rights. I don't agree with the judicial activism label. Don't agree with this being a religious issue. Don't agree with, you know, with this being, you know, a conservative issue. To us, this is a rights issue. What are the rights of people under guardianship?
We're talking to Stephen Drake with the disability rights group Not Dead Yet in Chicago. Ken Goodman joining us from the University of Miami, director of the bioethics program there, who's been following the Schiavo case for the 15 years that it has been in the news. We're also joined on the telephone now by Massachusetts Congressmember Democrat Barney Frank, and we welcome you as well to this discussion.
Thank you.
We started the beginning of the broadcast by broadcasting the comments of your colleague, Arizona Republican Trent Franks, talking about understanding that a person like Terry could wake up. He told that very compelling story of a nurse who had gone in to a woman who had a coma and sang to her every morning. Everyone made fun of her. She went off to another job. And when the woman woke up from this coma after years and they asked, "What do you remember?" she said she didn't remember people changing her bed. She remembered nothing but a woman singing. What is your response to this?
That we are dealing here with a specific situation that Congress has no business trying to decide on a case-by-case basis. This is a very difficult decision, and there are a number of specific factors here. The fact that one woman that Trent Franks talked about responded in this way is really not any way to decide the facts of the Schiavo case. The facts of the Schiavo case should dominate. How much damage has been done? Are there any prospects in her case for recovery? The fact that some person recovered once tells us obviously nothing about the chances of any kind of recovery or major change in circumstance here. We also have the question of her wishes, because I would agree that the wishes of the individual should be paramount. Now, the procedure by which we decide that is it went to court. It was very, very extensively litigated in court. And apparently every judge that was involved, from the trial judge and the appellate judges, decided based on what I understand is virtual unanimity among the doctors who examined her and her husband's testimony and other testimony, that she was in a condition which, according to her wishes, she would have wanted to happen, what's happening, the removal of the feeding tube. I do not understand how people think that the Congress of the United States, 535 elected officials, politicians, people who are subject to being lobbied, people who bring our ideologies to bear here, our own personal views about what the choices ought to be, presumes to make this decision. And Trent Franks telling the story, I think, is an example. I do not think in court, when we were trying to decide how ill Terry Schiavo was, what her situation was, does she have any feeling, is there any emotion there, is there anything more than breath, what would she have wanted, I don't believe that one instance would have had any real value, and it shouldn't have had any value in our decision. But we make decisions not in that same context. So I don't know what was the right thing to do or is the right thing to do regarding Terry Schiavo. I do think that it is clearly wrong for the Congress of the United States, this body of elected officials, driven more by ideology and by self-electoral considerations and advancement to other offices and re-election, shouldn't be trying to cancel out the decision made by the state of Florida.
Stephen Drake, your response of the disability rights group, Not Dead Yet.
Well, I think that, if Congressman Frank wants to get a better explanation of this, he should talk to his Senate colleague, Tom Harkin, who, even though the press gave it very little attention, held a press conference Saturday with some of his Republican colleagues and spoke very passionately about his years as a disability advocate and talking about this being a stopgap measure, but that he thought this really needed to be something that had to be addressed, in a broader context, but that more time needed, there was more time needed for that. That right now there aren't good protections for people under guardianship, and that really does need to be examined.
I would be all in favor of examining that. I would say this. First of all, one reason you don't have that at the federal level is that this has always been a decision made by the state courts. And I do not agree with those who have said, based on what we know, that the Florida courts were clearly wrong, that they didn't give her any rights. This was very extensively tried in Florida. Now, what is motivating this is a decision by the Congress of the United States, I think motivated by a combination of good and bad reasons, to cancel what Florida did. If people wanted to have a broader statute, that would be very important. Look, I think we have a lot of problems. The irony has to be stressed that at the time when they were passing this bill to overturn what Florida did, the Republicans in the House were cutting Medicaid very substantially. Now, a lot of the people we are talking
about... Absolutely.
A lot of the people we are talking about, as Stephen knows, who are in this kind of situation, are being paid for by Medicaid. So the contrast, the culture of life is coming up against the culture of greed, which says tax cuts for people making millions of dollars are much more important than adequate payment for Medicare for the people who would take care of anyone in Terry Schiavo's situation. But I still would then go back and say that if people want us to look at this overall, that's one thing. But that's not what we did. In fact, it says this is a non-precedential thing. It's only for the Terry Schiavo case, which I think is going to be hard to sustain. And it's one thing to mandate that there be a set of procedures that have to be followed. It's another for the politicians to intervene on a case-by-case basis and for people elsewhere in the country to think that if this very difficult, very emotion-laden, painful decision comes to them, that somebody might decide to politicize it and make it a big public issue. And, family disputes, unfortunately, in this kind of a situation, aren't all that unusual. Siblings can disagree. The children of an aging parent can disagree. We have parents versus husband, or it could be wife. I do not think Congress should have set this precedent, which we in fact did set, of deciding this case by case. And I don't think the kind of argument you heard from Trent Franks belongs in a rational discussion about what to do in this particular case.
Stephen Drake of Not Dead Yet.
Yeah, there were a lot of factors that led to this, and I think there's nobody I know in the disability community that was happy about the bill that was passed or the time crunch. What we would really like to see is to have, a serious and thoughtful exploration of the broader picture. I think there's problems with the evaluation of people with cognitive disabilities. What's the accuracy of families? And this goes beyond Terry Schiavo. There's also been moves in California, where some of the same laws about using a fairly low standard of proof to withdraw a feeding tube tried to apply it not just to people in persistent vegetative state, but to people in what they call minimally conscious state. People, nobody was arguing were unconscious, but who couldn't communicate in an effective way. There's a lot going on that goes beyond just these simple things around persistent vegetative state.
Ken Goodman of the University of Miami.
And what's significant here is that we're talking about one particular medical intervention. Why are we not talking about ventilators or dialysis or chemotherapy? The effect of trying to make this a disability case has the effect of unraveling what had been settled across the board for a generation. Namely, that people have the right to refuse medical devices, either themselves if they're able or through their family members if they're not able. When Representative Frank's saying this is not the business of the Congress, what he's saying is that this is something that's a difficult decision decision in any family, but it's made every day around the country in a way that is respectful, in a way that's decent, in a way that does not cause any suffering, in a way that hews to all faith traditions and all moral systems, to introduce the Terri Schiavo case to try and unravel that accord, when in fact the mere existence of a medical device can't impose on you the duty to use it, can only be explained by narrow ideological concerns. Not Dead Yet has raised our consciousness about the needs of people with disabilities for more public support, for more accommodation, for more of the sorts of things that your allies in this case have so far not been willing, either in Florida or in Washington, to give you a second's notice. They're using Not Dead Yet in the Terri Schiavo case for despicable purposes, when in fact the disability community has no reason to believe that there's any discrimination against a person with handicaps here at all. The ideology of it is really quite frightening.
Let me bring Congress. Stephen
Drake. Nobody uses Not Dead Yet. We're very clear. One thing I haven't said here, let me say very clearly. We align on specific issues. And the way we look at it, we see scary things on the left and the right. The left are developing a scary knee-jerk reaction to salute any better dead than disabled policy that comes along. And on the right, they seem to be looking at the slow approach, the slow torturous route to kill us off through withholding and withdrawal of vital services, medical supports, and that. We see it on both ends. We are not aligned, you know, as friends necessarily of either end of the spectrum.
Let me bring Congressmember Barney Frank back into this discussion around the issue of politics and the time that the Schiavo case comes. ABC coming out with this memo that supposedly was circulated to Senate Republicans about the significance of this moment. Tom DeLay in big trouble, ethical trouble himself, targeting Senator Nelson in Florida, saying that he is vulnerable in his next election. Barney Frank, can you talk about this?
Yes, it is an example of why we should not be doing this. And can I appreciate what Mr. Goodman said. Let me be clear. When I say it's not the business of Congress, it's not the function of Congress to make a case-by-case determination. We're not capable of doing that, and we certainly didn't do it in this case. It is entirely reasonable for people to come to Congress from the disability community and say, look, we've done a survey, and we believe nationally procedures are too weak, and let's look at it. People have analogized this to the civil rights movement. And in the case of race, particularly in the South, we did step in and say, wait a minute, you know what's traditionally been states' rights, we're going to take away. But that was after a very serious study had established a pattern of discrimination against African Americans. And I don't know whether such a pattern exists or not. I do know there are some legitimate differences. I've debated and argued with some members of the disability community. I strongly believe that we should be simply honoring individual choice. Now, I'm a supporter of the Oregon-assisted suicide law. I've had some people in the disability community tell me they don't like that. They think it leads to pressures on individuals who can't withstand them. So there are going to be some legitimate differences of opinion once we establish the primacy even of individual choice. I would honor individual choices that some people wouldn't honor, feeling perhaps that because of circumstances, it's not a real choice. And it's certainly the case, I think we would all agree in this, that as you reduce the financial resources available for what are sometimes very expensive efforts for people to maintain some kind of life, that you probably increase the pressures for people to make the death decision. I agree with that, and I think that's one of the things that makes it seem very hollow to me when the right-wingers cut the budgets and cut taxes and deny adequate resources and then say, but we're for the culture of life, because I think they have increased pressures in the other direction. Now, to get to your specific question, I'm not surprised by that. I mean, basically, what that memo says is politicians, 536 of us, George Bush, 100 senators, and 435 members of the House of Representatives, elected officials who run for office and who worry about re-election and et cetera, and majorities of the public, that politicians making an important decision that gets national attention are calculating the political advantages. That is further evidence of why we should not, it's confirmation of why we shouldn't be involved. It also does show, yes, there is on the Republican side, a combination of genuinely sincere people who, I believe, want inappropriately to impose their particular religious views on others in matters that don't affect and shouldn't affect the public policy. But also there are some very clever people who exploit the sentiments, and that this is a part of it. Because, as Mr. Goodman said, this sort of thing happens, sadly, fairly frequently. We have these kind of illnesses or accidents, And yes, the fact that this one case got blown up, clearly politics was a factor in it.
On that note, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Barney Frank, Congressmember from Massachusetts, Democrat, Ken Goodman, Director of the Bioethics Program at the University of Miami, and Stephen Drake, Research Analyst for the disability rights organization Not Dead Yet. When we come back, we look at the privatization of water on this World Water Day. Stay with us.
If you want to go wash, no water you go use. To buffet bear, if you want cook soup, no water you go use. Water could cool them. Tomo bandagba, oh, me lo malo. If you're a child, they grow, water can go use. If water kill your child, now water you go use.
Water, Get No Enemy by Fela Kuti here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 300 radio and television stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and NPR stations, public access TV and PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as on DirecTV Channel 375, and with video and audio stream at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Today is Water Day. 2005.
This water is now in a stage of crisis. And due to the rapid increase of the world's population, this situation is expected to become even more serious.
So the challenge here is to provide access to all the unserved people at an affordable price. My experience as a water professional is that it is possible. It is possible, but there are conditions.
The political question really is who owns water and who gets to control water. Here you're going to hear, or you are hearing, two very, very different visions of a future for water. On one side are those who see water as an economic good, to put water on the open market for sale to the highest bidder. On the other hand, you're going to hear the voice of a growing civil society movement who has a vision of water as a part of the global commons and treated as a public trust for all time by governments everywhere.
People were killed by the army because what you are saying here.
Somebody has to pay for water, ladies and gentlemen, whether it's the users or the future generations. That is the reality.
An excerpt of the documentary Thirst, produced by Alan Snitow and Deborah Kaufman. This year, World Water Day marks the launching of the Water for Life decade, during which the United Nations and governments are seeking to halve the number of people without access to safe drinking water and basic sanitation by the year 2015. The United Nations says more than 1.1 billion people around the world lack safe water, and almost 2.5 billion have no access to sanitation. sanitation, leading to over 3 million deaths every year. Almost a fifth of all children lack even the bare minimum of safe water they need to live. Water issues extend to indigenous people's rights, global warming, and boundary issues. Today, we focus on water privatization here in this country, in Detroit and Stockton, California. In mid-2003, a $600 million utilities privatization contract handed operating control of the Stockton water, wastewater, and stormwater systems to international conglomerate OMI Thames. The Stockton City Council voted on the contract amid public outcry. This is an excerpt from the documentary Thirst. It begins with OMI President Don Evans speaking in front of the council.
We'll safeguard the water of Stockton. You have the absolute commitment of our company, and you have the commitment of Thames Water to deliver this contract effectively. That's also, as the president, my personal commitment to you.
It is clear that the decision to privatize has been made covertly without a public vote.
I don't think the people at home realize how many hundreds of people were here and that it's all filled up back here and downstairs and that it was hard to hear. So I appreciate you.
City Council members, by signing this contract without the vote of the people, you will be betraying the people you supposedly represent. Water is life. This company, OMI Thames, wants to profit from our water. Water for life, not for profit.
I'm ashamed that we followed this path and have gone down the road of making something happen that was not consensus building, not citizen involved. It was basically handed down as a dictate. This is not the principle of an all-America city.
Okay, Councilmember Giovanetti.
Thank you. I'm prepared to approve this contract tonight ahead of the so-called vote of the people. There comes a time when the people become so involved in an issue that it is important that they be heard by way of the ballot.
As a Christian, I've always felt that prayer is very powerful. And when this process began, I have always prayed for guidance on what I should do. It says it in the Constitution that you will elect representatives to vote and to make decisions that are best for you.
We have not been elected to babysit and maintain the city until a vote can be taken by the citizens on major issues.
I do not feel they are too dumb to understand.
Nobody said that.
And, you know, the people who founded this republic obviously didn't think the people were too dumb to run it.
Neither Gloria and I or anyone on this council believes that the people are too dumb to resolve or to understand the issue. That's not what we
say. All right, quiet down. Officers, close the door, please. Tonight, I want to thank the council for their indulgence and their endurance and their hard work to come up with whatever their answers are tonight. Do I believe that this should go to a vote of the people? Absolutely not. And that's for no more reason than I can think any government by initiative is good. There's been a motion and a second. I'm calling for the question. Please cast your votes. Carries 4-3. Thank you all for all your hard work.
And that was the former mayor of Stockton, Podesto. They did vote to privatize the water supply, but that was in 2003. This is an excerpt of the film Thirst that is playing around the country. We're joined by one of its producers, Alan Snitow, by Desiree Bagaleos, a member of the Concerned Citizens Coalition of Stockton. Can you tell us what happened since then?
Right now, the lawsuit, after they voted, we went around and collected signatures, basically to put a stop to it. And unfortunately, we failed. We came up short with the signatures, and so we ended up taking them to court over it. And it's been in court since then. We're in the appeals process. On the 28th of this month, it goes to the state appellate courts. And so we're waiting to see what the courts have to
Very
say.
Briefly, why are you against it? The
why
privatization
am I against
of water.
Because First of all, it was the one municipality in our city that was making money for the city, and it's not that even at all. There was no reason to privatize it ever, and what it comes down to is that ever since this has happened, there's been absolutely no accountability. We're losing more water. You know, there's more water missing that's not accounted for. The service has gone to hell, basically. They promised a 24-hour hotline, and if you call that hotline number, the number's disconnected, or you get rerouted to the fire department. And, I mean, what it comes down to is that it once, like, you know, we had access to this, and now that access is gone because you're dealing with a multinational company, and the rules are different.
Let me ask Alan Snitow what happened to the mayor.
Well, the mayor ran for higher office in the most expensive state legislative campaign in American history, and he lost. And he lost even in the areas of Stockton itself, and the privatization of water and the controversy around that was a major reason for his defeat, because what people thought was that this issue about who controls water is really one of the fundamental issues of democracy. And as you see in the film, they're all talking about whether the people get a right to decide or not. And this is what's happening now really all over the world as a major multinational corporation. Corporations among the 100 largest in the world are really taking over water supplies very fast with the idea that this is the oil of the next century.
Maureen Taylor also joins us on the line. She's state chair of the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization in a race for a city council seat in Detroit. Can you talk about privatization of water there?
Yes. We're in another phase of this fight. The privatization of water concept here is being operated under the guise of shutting off water for residents of the city of Detroit. In the last 90 days of the year 2004, the Water and Sewage Department, which is a municipal-owned entity, shut off water at 6,200 additional households in just 90 days. So what's happening here, because we have such a horrible decline in the amount, the numbers of people that are working, and we have a horrible increase in the number of people that are having to seek government assistance and welfare and whatnot, you're being punished because you're poor. Here, you can have your water turned off, and at some point, the whole question of privatization, meaning an explicit company or corporation, is going to be brought in by the water czar, Mr. Victor Mercado, to run the water department.
The company that wants to take it over?
There are many. Water, we're living in inside of the Great Lakes. There's no end to the amount of great water and fresh water that's available to folks here. So there are numbers of people. It's like sharks. It's like jaws. There's a feeding frenzy going on here. So by having this entire crisis, 40,000 people shut off of water between June of 2001 and June of 2002, 40,000 in just Detroit. And along with this additional 6,000, when you create this chaos and whatnot that's going on in this, the Motor City, then you have folks that are standing on the periphery saying, I can run this better. And if your citizens will pay me and pick me and the elected officials will choose me to be the water company and whatnot, then I can make I can make the water better. But, of course, I can make my pockets better.
We have 15 seconds. Alan Snitow, how does Detroit fit into the global picture?
Well, a little bit. We're talking about a case in Florida right now in which one woman is getting the attention of Congress about cutting off her food tube. Thousands of people are being cut off from water in Detroit and many other cities around the world right now. And this all comes together on the question of who is going to control this resource in the future. Enron was a water company. Uruguay has just voted against having any water privatization there. This is a global issue now, and we've got new Enrons on the horizon, and the area is water rather than energy.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us on this World Water Day. Desiree Bagaleos of Concerned Citizens Coalition of Stockton, Alan Snitow with Deborah Kaufman made the film Thirst. Their website is thirstthemovie.org, and Maureen Taylor, Michigan Welfare Rights Organization. That does it for the program. Look forward to seeing people on our Unembed the Media Tour. Monday, we begin in New York at Ethical Culture Society. You can go to our website for tickets at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.